So state-level immunization requirements have played a major role in decreasing and keeping the rates of vaccine-preventable diseases low in this country. Obviously, these laws have certain exemptions. All states currently allow medical exemptions. And as of last year, 48 states had religious exemptions, and 21 states allowed for personal belief or philosophical exemptions to these requirements. It has been previously shown that having an exemption is associated with a higher risk of acquiring a vaccine-preventable disease. For example, in a nationwide study, it was shown that kids with exemptions were 35 times more likely to contract measles. And in a separate study, it was shown that kids with exemptions were 22 times more likely to have measles and almost 6 times more likely to have pertussis. But these studies focused on individual-level risk of acquiring vaccine-preventable diseases. Why is this important? Because we, in a previous study, documented that the rates of non-medical exemptions are increasing at the state level. And this, if we break down the exemption rates by states that allow only religious exemptions versus those that allow broader philosophical exemptions, we saw that these states were majorly responsible in that in the observable increase in rates of state-level exemptions. If you categorize states by the administrative difficulty in obtaining non-medical exemptions in each of those states, we see that, again, in states that had easy exemption policies, and you know the criteria for assigning these categories was published before we did our study, that these rates have been climbing over the last 19 years. So the analysis ended in 2004 for this previous study. So there was some initial evidence that the number of exemptors in a community affects the incidence of measles in non-exempt populations. For example, there was evidence that school-based outbreaks were associated with exemption rates. And then we documented in a separate study that there was within state variability at the school level in implementation of exemption requirements. And obviously, I guess most of you know these are state level law, but the implementation happens at the school level. And there's some evidence of variability in exemption rates at the state level. This slide shows a map of Washington by county, and as you can see, there's a huge range of exemption rates with certain counties with remarkably high rates of non-medical exemptions. So keeping that in mind, we did our study in Michigan, and we wanted to look at whether exemption rates are geographically clustered, and to determine if exemption clusters are associated with clustering of pertussis. And we chose pertussis as our example for broader question of vaccine-preventable diseases because we had enough numbers. Unfortunately, we have enough numbers of cases of pertussis to be able to observe this phenomenon. So we obtained data on census tract population and boundaries from the U.S. Census Bureau. Pertussis cases by year and census tract slash point location were obtained from Michigan Department of Health. Number of exemptions in school-aged children by school address were, again, obtained from Michigan Department of Health. Being an epidemiologist, I get excited by methods, so those of you who are not that, who don't share this enthusiasm, now is the time to check your BlackBerries. But we used this method called Kulldorff's scan statistic, and I'll go a little bit, I'll describe that method because it's relatively new, and it has a lot of potential to be applied to similar questions in the analysis of vaccine-preventable diseases. In our analysis, we categorize census tracts as being inside or outside a cluster. Then we used good old logistic regression for overlap between exemption clusters and pertussis clusters. So the odds ratios that we calculated can be interpreted of a census tract's status of being inside versus outside an exemptions cluster, which is our exposure variable, and a pertussis cluster, which is our outcome variable. So spatial scan statistics, at least the permutation that we used, were proposed by Kaldorf in 1997. The way it works is that the software takes your spatial data and generates, looks at your spatial plane and generates random data sets under a known null hypothesis. So what would data look like? What could be the spatial pattern of data if we knew that there was no clustering present? And so it does that 999 times. That's the convention, but you can go up or down. And what it does is that it, in your spatial plane, it takes, divides it into different grid points, and around each grid point, it draws a window and expands the size of that window such that it stops at the level where the contrast of the number of events inside a class, a window compared to outside a window is maximized. So if you have a cluster somewhere, the contrast between the number of cases inside the window would be highest if there's a cluster present compared to outside, and that's where it stops. And then it moves on to the next point, and so on and so forth. It's a cumbersome process, and it does that. And for example, a single run of pertussis data from Michigan took me like 4 or 5 days to do that. So it does that under a null hypothesis, then looks at our real data and does that for our real data as well. And it does all the same computations for the two. So the purpose of doing it under the null hypothesis is to generate this histogram, this distribution of the test statistic, which is again based on the contrast, and to see that what would be the value of that test statistic if we had, under a null hypothesis, and compares our observed data, so the clusters identified by our observed data, and plots it against that and see if they fall within the 5% range of that distribution. So the good old cutoff of 0.05 of p-value comes into play, and the clusters that are that fall in the extreme side of this distribution are considered statistically significant. And if you want to look at the time variable as well, you can do space-time clustering, which we did for our pertussis data because it makes sense to do it for an acute disease like pertussis to not only look at long-term phenomenon of spatial clustering, but to look at space-time clustering. So instead of an expanding window, we introduce a third axis and we take it as an expanding cylinder. The good thing about this methodology is that it identifies geographically grounded clusters. Several other tests that have been in use for several years tell you that there is clustering present, and then you have to look at the map and guess, oh, this is the cluster that's giving us our significance. But that doesn't help if you're running a program. You really want to know that, where is the specific location of your cluster so that you can intervene. It does not assume a cluster size, but it does assume, that's a drawback, a cluster shape. And so therefore, the boundaries are not that precise, but the location is reasonably accurate as predicted by this kind of methodology. Now the fun stuff. So this map shows location of space-time plus pertussis clusters indicated by this pattern in pink, and the schools in exemption clusters. And I have data at the individual level, but obviously due to privacy reasons that I cannot, we haven't been able to publish that, and therefore I avoid showing it as well. We used individual level point addresses for actually getting to these census tracts in pertussis clusters, but the schools are identified in this slide at the individual point locations, and you can see there's considerable overlap. This is more clarified; it's more apparent in this slide, where we see the overlap between census tracts in pertussis clusters and census tracts in exemption clusters in blue. And if you blow this up, it's remarkable in the Detroit metropolitan area. And when you try to quantify that using a proper statistical model, the unadjusted odds ratio of overlap is 3, And even if you adjusted for state-level demographic, for census tract-level demographic variable, we still get a remarkably high or reasonably high odds ratio of overlap between clusters of exemptions and clusters of pertussis. So what the main impact of our finding, the implication of our finding, is that people with certain kinds of attitudes regarding vaccines tend to live together. There was anecdotal evidence, and now I think we have reasonably robust statistical evidence of that. The second part is a no-brainer, because if you have an infectious disease, it will tend to cluster. But the fun part is, as I showed, that there's an overlap between clusters of exemptions and clusters of vaccine-preventable diseases, at least a vaccine-preventable disease. So going beyond the proof of concept, what interests us is that you can actually identify high-risk geographical areas. And if you step back, the implication on the ground level is that most of us do believe in vaccines. Most parents do get their kids vaccinated. And a significant proportion of these individuals who were in our case data were vaccinated. And, you know, I'm sure you know, 80% or 90% vaccine efficacy means, by definition, that even if you do the right thing, you have a chance of being vulnerable to a vaccine-preventable disease 20% of the time, or 10% of the time, depending on the efficacy of the vaccine. And that's not counting waning immunity, et cetera. So up until now, people do believe in vaccines, but they don't feel a stake. A lot of people do not feel a stake in having a higher number of vaccine refusers in their community. But we try to demonstrate that it's in everyone's interest to make sure that we have high community level vaccination rate. It does impact my kid, whether his school has high immunization or exemption rates, where the kids who come to his or her playground are vaccinated or not. And we have, I guess, pretty robustly demonstrated, but I'm biased because I did the analysis. The other implication is, we had previously shown in a separate paper that came out last year that state-level exemption policies are associated with actual rates of disease. So we demonstrated that even after adjusting for a bunch of demographic variables at the state, states that allowed personal belief exemptions had 50% higher rates of pertussis over 19 years. And states, similar incidence rate ratios were seen for states with easy exemption policies. But that was state-level data. Now this new study shows that even if you have reasonable state-level rates, if you have a critical mass of susceptible people in your community, everyone is vulnerable. And that's an important message that we need to get out. And the second phase of this study will look at several other states. Thank you.
That was interesting. Thank you. I have a question for you. Did you see a difference in your age distribution between your clusters, your exemption clusters, and the non-exemption areas in your pertussis cases? Did you look at that?
In terms of the age of individuals, no.
No, okay. No. That'd be interesting to look at. So now we're going to take questions. I ask you to come up to the microphone if you have a question.
So we looked at it, and we didn't see it.
Oh, so you didn't see it. So yeah, similar. Yeah. Okay.
So we looked for it, but didn't see a difference.
These are three great talks. Nobody has any questions? No? Okay.
In the areas where you were studying, oftentimes providers don't, that's physicians, they just assume a cough is a cough. So were they more encouraged to do the test to see if the child's cough was secondary to pertussis, or was there any random increase in you encouraging the providers to check?
We actually compared the provider characteristics, compared the case characteristics, that, you know, percent hospitalization, et cetera, to look at proxies for bias. We actually found that reporting was hospitalization, proportion of hospitalized case was better in the non-cluster area, slightly better, not that huge in magnitude. So that would imply that if anything, our results, at least in that context, whatever we could measure, were a little conservative. Having said that, we did not have a perfect measure of documenting reporting bias, and that may very well have remained in our data. And so we are going to replicate it in other states and look at some of try to measure some of those variables.
Anyone else? All right, I have. Oh, great. Trying to get to the mic is challenging.
Hello, I'm Shannon DeZuba with Novartis Vaccines. Thank you all for your presentations. I really appreciated them today. Clarification, Kathleen, I was hoping you could speak to your data indicated a potential decrease in serogroup B with vaccination. Can you speak any more about reporting versus?
I wouldn't say that would be due to the vaccine by any stretch. The trends were that serogroup B had declined across age groups, but none of those rate differences were significant. Okay. And just looking at the proportion of cases that were serogroup B, that actually remained stable, whereas proportion of cases that were serogroup C and Y increased.
Okay.
So it's unclear why that is, if it's just that those were more likely to be identified, but you know, there isn't really a good hypothesis for that either. So it could just be that there was more serogroup C and Y floating around in this population.
Okay, and you said this is going to be baseline data, so you're planning on
continuing.
Yeah, we're
going to keep looking
well
at this closely to see if we're finding any impact.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
I have a related question. In your pie chart, were there any reasons for why you had such a large number of unknown serogroups?
I think largely because the state lab surveillance has been enhanced so much over the recent years. Mm-hmm. So prior to that, it was mostly county labs doing identification and not doing serogroup identification.
Because that would make some of it's hard to make any conclusions given that large number of unknown in the pre-year.
Hi, Barb Watson, Philadelphia. I'd like to ask two questions, one to Kathleen, one to Zach. In terms of the meningococcal, are you seeing any vaccine failures?
We've seen only two cases that we've identified that a person was vaccinated and still came down with disease.
Types.
Both were serogroup Y.
Okay.
And neither were a fatality, so I don't know if disease was modified at all and they were less severe. Both young adults.
Mm-hmm. We've had a fatality in a serogroup C, and we've had three vaccinated cases who were also vaccine failures, serogroup C. So I was just trying to get a sense, as anybody else seeing that, and is it not, it may be concurrent issues that are bacterial load versus true vaccine failure. Mm-hmm. And a question for you, Sat, is this is great stuff. Have you considered how you could implement it or share it with the schools to encourage more efficient exemption criteria?
Yeah. So even before this project, there are a couple of things that we want to do in terms of action. After we do the phase two with two additional states, we're trying to do three, but couldn't get data from one of the states. After we do that, we intend to propose two actions. The first one, actually the intervention study started before that, where we provided certain training and I'm not the PI of that project, but was from within our team. We provided, it was a randomized trial of providing mm-hmm. information to school nurses mm-hmm. and some, you know, a bit of training by vaccine experts to see if that has an impact on implementation or not. The other thing I want to do in terms of the specific action is to do a little bit of mathematical modeling of this and to identify a threshold beyond which clustering. So again, so we saw that if you have that critical mass of susceptible individuals, you have potential for outbreaks. So clustering of pertussis mm-hmm. was a proxy for outbreaks. And to do that, as of now, states report to the CDC, the overall exemption rates. And as we as I just discussed, that may not be enough to look at the true risk at the community level. So once we identify that threshold, it may be useful to have an easy method. So you would run a procedure on the data you already collect, but just with additional geographic information, which is easily available. And you would identify that statistic that would tell you that your risk of actual clustering within the state. Once we do that, the idea is to make, hopefully, again, this takes time to do that, to make easily, tools make, as of now, after our paper comes out and it's in press, this particular one, we could easily work with states to develop some, using the same method and replicating our analysis at the state level. But what would be even better to have an interactive tool where they could actually take their state data from the immunization registries, et cetera, and then come up with a risk profile at the community level. That would require programming, and I'm an academic, and for me it would require some funding to get resources to actually do this kind of stuff. But right now, once the paper comes out, we are ready to share our tools at the state level right now.
Now, a previous person asked, I think it was James asked you, had you done the age, which you had. One of the things we've used our registry for and the geographic thing, and been able to show that it's really teenage moms who have no prenatal care that are the under-vaccinated, and those definitely cluster. The issue then, there also may end up being where the outbreaks certainly of pertussis are too. Any idea how you can use your methodology to attack that side of things?
Well, the methodology, we actually, our group, I'm not the lead author on that, but our group did an analysis of the NIS data, and we also show that maternal age is, so we looked at different factors. Influencing immunization coverage are well known, and they have been analyzed. Well, several people have come up with different factors. So we wanted to weigh the relative importance of these factors using CART analysis to see which ones of these are predicting the highest variability in immunization rate. And lo and behold, our maternal age was the biggest factor influencing coverage amongst all of the others. I don't know about this method, but I think that when that paper comes out, we're going to push a little more on that side.
So hypothetically, you could use the school exemptions and tie it to maternal age for some kind of issue to try and do.
But you could do that directly as well. So you could look at maternal age and do and we have the point I'm trying to make. We have other evidence using more conventional methods that shows that maternal age is a factor. And you can make policy, you can push even without this kind of analysis.
This is a very important issue for us in Oregon. In Oregon, we have also identified major clusters of personal exemptions among our parents. We did a case control study and we stratified by level of exemption. And actually, we didn't find maternal age as being particularly predictive in our population. Really, it was personal beliefs. And we actually created an index to look at the strength of those beliefs. And there are some parents in some clustered communities that really do not believe in vaccines. We don't think we can convince them. However, there are a number of parents that are on the fence, and they may exempt or they may not exempt. And we need to do a better job of finding out what kind of information that they need. So this is very valuable to
We are working on certain interventions. And it's, if I remember from your, you identified a major cluster around Ashland.
Yeah.
And you found that the books in the library, if you look at the books in the library, tend to be anti-vaccine around that area. Right. So that was an interesting finding. Yeah. So it's a bigger,
We actually did something about that. We went to the libraries and asked them to start including information, accurate information about vaccinations. But
Yeah, Charlie LeBaron from the MMR unit. As you know, we have issues around vaccine refusal and so forth, and I congratulate you on your presentation. Charlie LeBaron. And the reason I was a little bit late is I came from a presentation about refusal to accept flu vaccine among nurses in a large facility. And what they discovered is they got to 100% acceptance. And the way they did is say you can refuse vaccine, you have to wear a mask the entire flu season. In essence, if you make it easier to refuse than to get vaccinated, you're in a situation where, in a sense, you're promoting lack of vaccination. So I like the approach that you're taking around intervention possibilities. The question I have is along those lines. There's anecdotal evidence to suggest, and I don't know if you have the evidence, that not only do refusers cluster geographically, but they cluster by provider. That there are providers who are basically either refusal friendly or refusal permissive or refusal tolerant. The advantage of knowing that that's true is it provides a leverage point where you can at least work on small numbers of people to potentially have effect on larger numbers of people. And I was wondering if you have any data that would...
We actually have empirical evidence from two sides. The first is we did a case control study of parents. Our group did that a while ago. And compared parents of exemptors and an exemptor, I know it's not a real English word, JAMA coined it for us, and you know, whatever they say goes. So exemptors, parents of exemptors were, and compared them to parents of vaccinated kids, and we found that not only it was associated with the types of providers, they were more likely to go to CAMS, complementary and alternative providers. Their belief and looking at how much trust they had in their healthcare provider was also an important factor. So we did a provider level study, which is in press, soon to come out, where we looked at parents' beliefs and providers' beliefs, and we found remarkable synergy between the two. And I think that's, again, evidence that we need to intervene at the provider level. We are working on interventions geared at providers. So they're different. It's a matter of scale. So you need to work at the school level. You need to work at the parental level. You need to work at the provider level. You need to work at the level of legislation. And you know, our geographic data show that you need to work at the community level where you know people do not perceive it as their kids being at risk if they do the right thing. So there are different levels, and I absolutely agree providers you know, are an important factor.
Thank you.
That's great. I just want to add that we looked at providers just in a more qualitative way after our case control study in Oregon. And we actually went to high exemption areas and looked for providers that were still giving shots, but were not giving shots, they were giving shots off recommendations. And we actually talked with them, and they basically told us that they're really trying to accommodate parents that come in with very, very much concerned, and they don't want to lose them. So we need to figure out how do we support those providers and figure out how to help them bring the parents a little bit more on whatever the recommendations. But we don't want to lose people when they have true concerns. I also wanted to mention the clustering. I was at APHA earlier this year presenting about our case control study, and the impression I got, a colleague from CDC talked about there not being personal exemptions not being as big a problem when you look on the global end of at the state level, but very little has been done around clustering, and I bet you in each of your states you have clusters of very concerned parents, and those clusters are probably growing.
Yeah, and that's the whole idea. If you have a critical, even with overall high coverage, if you have a critical mass of susceptible it's almost an epidemiological no-brainer that you're going to have disease.